Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae on News Talk.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McCrae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading and rating, letting people know about the pod. Really appreciate it. Coming up on this week's episode, we're going to be talking about writing and the origins of it, because it's been long thought that writing began around 10,000 years ago, but new research and potentially AI-assisted understanding leads us to believe that it could be as old as 40,000 years old, rewriting once again what we knew about early humankind. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. We get to all of your comments at the end of the pod. First, though, it's time to look back at some of the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Shane Bergen, physicist at UCD, and from Research Ireland, Dr. Ruth Freeman. Shane, our first story has to do with mirrors. I saw this story and I thought, this is not real.
Yeah, I thought it was an April Fool's story, but it's so hard to tell these days. and for listeners of a Gen X vintage, they may remember the Simpsons episode where Mr. Burns decided to block out the sun and then to charge people, make more money from all the power they'd need to light up their world. This is sort of like that, right? Dastardly. Except what the so-called clever engineers are trying to do here at Reflective Orbital, a startup, is to put giant mirrors in space that would be able to illuminate 5 to 6 kilometer square patches of the Earth's surface. So at night, they'd be able to shine down reflected sunlight onto blocks of land on the Earth and to light it up. And they're able to kind of tune the lighting level, they say, from full moon brightness to full noon brightness. So kind of from dim low light to full whack.
This is both insane and amazing and also really worrying.
Oh,
right? It's all three.
It's completely
it's
insane.
Fascinating.
Absolutely, yeah.
So they have light that comes from the sun, is reflected against a giant mirror floating in space, and they can basically put a spotlight, like you're on stage in the dark, wherever you go.
Yeah, I'm going to resist the thing about floating, because they're not floating. They're just there in space.
Well, they're orbiting in space, whatever.
Jumping on this is SpaceX, right? The company I've always loved to hate. And what they're planning to do is put over 1 million small satellites in space as well, and in low Earth orbit. And they're trying to build effectively a network in space that they say would be able to run AI-type workloads. So they say it would remove the heating and cooling element of having data centers on the Earth's surface. But of course, as well as that, it would have a massive effect on the diffuse light levels in the Earth's night sky. So things would seem brighter all the time everywhere. So both of these stories are examples of how humans are able to affect planetary scale systems, most notably here, the light levels. And it's completely fundamental. Like the idea of night and day is absolutely fundamental to every living thing. And I don't just mean humans and our sense of getting a good night's sleep. I mean plants, I mean animals of all species. We've all evolved.
Okay, so I knew you were going to go down this road. And I just want to stop you for a second. Just the idea of it itself is really cool. It is possible to create daytime anywhere where it's nighttime. And that I think that's really, really cool. I don't think it's a good idea, but I think the idea of itself, that you can point a mirror somewhere and it's pitch dark and you press a button, it locates your GPS, which is the idea, and then they can provide a patch of light in pitch darkness. I mean, obviously, operationally for the military or for search and rescue, like there's lots of really good uses for this technology.
Yeah, but you don't let the one in a million good reason be the justification for something that would cause massive ruination, right? So the idea
you're
that
very like
no, I'm worried about companies like this being able to sell a good idea and like a small good idea. And then, of course, it moves from being a 5 or 6 kilometer zone to a city or a county or a country. And then all of a sudden you're able to wage war on other countries by effectively doing what we would do in torture chambers, which is keeping the lights on for people all the time. It's not okay. And it's terrifying that 2,500 scientists have to write to the United States commission that look after the low Earth orbit of the Earth and complained to them that this is not a good idea. This is reckless.
I disagree with 2,500 scientists. I think it's a really cool idea that should never happen. Let's just all agree.
Okay.
It shouldn't happen, but it's a really cool idea. They should have started with that. Look, we totally acknowledge how cool this idea is to be able to flick on a light switch anywhere in the world. I think that's cool.
The insects would love it.
Yes, they would. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. What's left of them. Like massive insect infestation.
You tell them, Ruth.
Ruth, our second story is even more interesting. It has to do with toast.
Well, it's more, maybe it may impact on us more, and it is to do with toast. And you know when you walk into a room and that delicious smell of bread toasting, and that's because of something called the Maillard reaction, where you get all this lovely toasty goodness. You get sugars and amino acids that can get converted into other compounds that give toast that much better flavour than bread. But there is a kind of hidden shadow to this lovely reaction, which is there is an amino acid called asparagine, and it reacts in this reaction and it turns into something called acrylamide. And acrylamide has been classified...
Anything ending in mide is never very good, is it?
Yeah, well, it's been classified as a probable carcinogen. And that's because when you do tests and you give huge amounts of it to animals, you know, it does cause cancer. We can't say absolutely definitively because it's very hard to track the intake because, you know, you get it from lots and lots of different places, but it does seem to be associated with cancer. So there's been guidance out for about 8 or 9 years, this idea go for gold. So when you're toasting your bread or you're roasting your potatoes, don't go for the really deep, dark colours because that's where you get a lot of acrylamide.
Barbecue, you know, like a dark barbecue is bad.
Anything burnt, all that charcoal, that's all acrylamide. And it's particularly in starchy things like potato, wheat, but also parsnips, that kind of thing.
Right.
But maybe there is a science to the rescue here. So this is research from the Rotherham Institute in the UK. And people may know one of the things that happened after Brexit was the UK did change their laws on genetic modification. So they have more, I suppose, permissive
freedom.
Laws. Yeah. Yeah, more freedom compared to the rest of us in the EU. And what scientists have done, they've taken wheat and they've knocked out two genes that are responsible for producing asparagine in wheat. And what they've done is they've then been able to grow the wheat and there's no loss of production. Whereas they found they did a comparable kind of knockout using sort of more traditional breeding methods where you'd introduce mutagens and just screen the seeds afterwards. Whereas and they were able to reduce the amino acid in the wheat, but they lost a lot of production. So with the GM wheat, they've grown it. It looks like they've made bread and biscuits out of it.
Do they taste just as good?
Apparently they taste just as good. So this is really interesting. Now this is and it's a potentially straightforward health intervention where you're still getting the nice toasty flavour, you're just not getting as much acrylamide.
Right.
But it's going to introduce issues in terms of how the UK trades with the rest of the EU, although the EU is certainly looking at its laws, particularly around these new genetic technologies, to say because CRISPR can be so specific, in many ways it seems safer to regulators because what you're changing can be quite controlled and you may get fewer unintended consequences. So toasty toast might be back on the menu.
Very good. Where are you on the Pantone range where zero is and 10 is black?
6.
Yeah, I'm probably about a 7. What are you?
I'm about a 7, really.
Living on the edge.
Yeah, exactly.
Living on the edge.
Given the amount of amides I use when I was a PhD.
I didn't take you for a risk taker, Shane. Our third story has to do with AI slop.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a great one, right? Because it was intentional. There was a clever professor in Sweden called Almira Thornström, and she was teaching her students about how AIs generate knowledge, quote unquote. And what she did was she invented a fake illness and she wrote a fake paper and uploaded it to one of those preprint servers that many academics would be familiar with, where you put early work. And in it, she coined a new disease called Bi-Axonia Mania. And effectively, it's a dry eye type syndrome, so relatively innocuous, sore and itchy eyes. And she also wrote about it in Medium, a well-known place for publications. Not long after uploading her fake paper onto the archive, she found that if you typed in the conditions or the symptoms of the made-up disease into many of the large language models that the users and listeners are familiar with, they were they were very happy to suggest to people that they may have had the fake disease. So this is kind of interesting, not just because it swallowed the bait, but also because she put a number of things into the fake paper to kind of give the large language model clues that it was fake. For example, this paper is fake.
That's a pretty big clue. I was like,
she also had a fake university, a fake researcher, a fake city, acknowledged Starfleet Academy and the kindness of the lab on the Starship Enterprise, all within the stuff. It had tons of fake references. So far so normal. Like, you know, we're all familiar with AI garbage like this. But it is interesting that it didn't pick up on these flags. Instead, the large language models, more inclined to believe it because it looked official. And perhaps most worryingly, other researchers cited it in their real work. And that points to a growing concern that many of us have, which is that people are...
they're citing AI stuff, but they haven't read the paper.
They're using AI to write their papers, which is looking then in turn for papers. So they wouldn't have read it, nor would they have even...
Nobody could have read that paper and gone, this is a real paper, I must cite it in my work.
Yeah, so it's...
Yeah, so that's, there's a double whammy there.
Absolutely. So...
I don't know if it's responsible to be... testing live systems in that way, because you are effectively poisoning the public well, because a lot of people use these large language models, you know, and I've seen a lot of this where people are like, oh, we'll just, you know, we'll make something up and then we'll see if it gets into the large language model. Like, I believe there should be protections around those. And, you know,
I think you're right. And I think that the author herself realized that the experiment got out of the lab here, but it does point to how easy it is for us to put out fake information, and also sort of demonstrates. And I was talking to students about this just this week in a module I teach on trust and science about how we can use search engines and LLMs interchangeably, including myself. Let's be honest, I do it too. But it's just that we can't interpret the knowledge that it gives back in the same way. And caution should be applied. But I think it's very, very interesting in terms of what it says about scientific publishing and, you know, basically just how reliant we are on this now.
Caution should be applied from the guy who eats a grade 6 toast.
Seven, actually.
Ruth, our final story is very exciting because finally it seems we may have a male pill on the way.
Not a pill, a male jab. The equivalent, yeah, contraception. And you're right, this has been a long time coming because it's been about 60 years since there's been anything out there, you know, for men to be able to use. And it's interesting. The reason is because, you know, scientists have sort of focused on mimicking female reproduction, female contraception, which is hormonal. And of course, hormonal contraception has a whole swathe of side effects, including high blood pressure, nausea, headaches, mood changes, and the list goes on. And in fact, many researchers believe that even if scientists came up with something similar for men, that the side effects nowadays would be seen as too much for the drug to be approved. So this is a very different approach. And it's research that's been going on for 6 years, and it was published in the Proceedings of the National Academies of Sciences, and it was done at Cornell University. And they took a different approach, which is they targeted sperm production. And they targeted a protein which plays a key role during a particular kind of cell division called meiosis. So meiosis is not like the cell division that happens in the rest of your body, where a cell essentially clones itself and creates two identical copies. In meiosis, the cells, it's the opportunity to create gametes or sex cells that only have one copy of chromosomes, which of course can then go on and fertilize an egg. So there was a molecule called JQ1, which was initially developed for cancer research, because obviously, again, cell division in cancer is important, but it was shelved. So they brought it back out, and it targets these proteins which control meiosis, particularly this early phase called prophase, which is the bit where the genes all shuffle. So they tested it on mice. So they got an injection for 3 weeks, and then they analyzed what was happening, and they just stopped producing sperm completely. But the most important thing was after they stopped the treatment, within 6 weeks, sperm production seemed to be restored back to normal.
Wow.
And in fact, fertility was also completely restored with healthy offspring.
Wow.
So I guess the kind of potential here is that with 4 jabs a year, you could potentially have full contraception for a man. And I mean, at the moment, it's not possible because those side effects are still there. Mm. But certainly now that the pathway has been identified and the principle has been established, you know, they may well be able to come up with something which will work.
Very exciting. Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland, Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD. Thank you very much. Now, we're all familiar with cave paintings and the images of bison and mammoths and other large animals that our distant ancestors produced in the far depths of prehistory. But these are not the only depictions we see on artifacts in caves. There are also scratches and crosses and dots. And a new study has shown that they appear in certain specific patterns. And could these symbols from 40,000 years ago be the beginnings of a writing system? Well, Genevieve von Petzinger is a paleoanthropologist and rock art researcher and project director of the Liacar Project. She joins me now. Welcome to the program, Genevieve. This is actually really interesting because the difference, and we do this every once in a while on the program, the difference between what we thought we knew and what appears to be now the case is quite stark. So first off, let's talk about what we're talking about. When we talk about writing, what are we talking about?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on the program. I'm excited. I'm excited to talk about my favorite subject. The trend in the last 20 years, the last couple decades, has really been that we didn't even know what we didn't know. How I would describe my field. And so, you know, again, this new study, this new way of understanding the cave art from Europe and really from around the world, is part of us realizing that our ancestors were fully modern human and had lots of capacity to do really cool, complicated things. And so it's more that we just A, underestimated them, and B, our previous ways to understand them, and I mean like technologies like dating methods and things, limited us to being able to kind of understand how far back and maybe how broad these things were. So this is part, we're not slamming our previous generations, we're standing on their shoulders. Uh-huh. And now moving into new territory. But yeah, it's a fascinating thing to see how, you know, the geometric signs, which is kind of like, so cave art is divided into animals, humans, and geometric signs. And traditionally, the geometric sign, sort of the bucket, it's the bucket into which they threw everything that wasn't obviously an animal or a human.
Right.
And it seemed very abstract. And, you know, and researchers have certainly tried to tackle them and have thought about them. But it really, it needed, it's a type of science that needed to wait for the kinds of big data style projects that we're capable of now. And so this is where the new study that my colleagues in the field just undertook in Europe with the signs you alluded to, you know, one of the leads on that, he's a computational linguist. Like, that wasn't even a job.
Yeah.
20 some odd years ago, right? So it's like, as we have new ways to approach the art, we're learning really cool new things.
Okay, so when we're talking about writing, we have to be careful to be specific here, right? Because writing is, 100%. It's not just a picture. It's not just, an image or a word. Writing is sentences. Can you give me the definition there?
100%. Yeah. No, I literally spent part of my PhD learning the words to be able to explain the difference between cave art and writing. Because I get asked that a lot, right? And so what we have to understand is the human-wide practice of making visual marks on things, we would classify as being graphic communication because we are communicating in a graphic form, right? Yeah. Writing itself is a subset of that. It's like a specific subcategory. And I think writing itself would be defined as anything that you can speak, you can write. Like, there is a way to write it out. Mm. And so this is where in the modern world, we use a lot of alphabets, right? So that's a phonetics. So what we do is we have a small number of symbols that we mix and match, and we make the sounds go together to represent the words that we speak, right?
Yeah. And so that is a sort of the core tenet of what a writing system
correct.
Is.
Correct. But yeah, and so that's where, yeah, and it's standardized. So again, anybody who's been in school knows that what happens if you spell something wrong on a spelling test, it's wrong. So there's that enforcement of a system and a standard. And this is where we only see those appear in a very narrow set of circumstance, which is usually large-scale society. It's urban, it's hierarchical, and there's information that they want to be able to share with large numbers of people. Mm. And writing makes it easy to do that.
Yeah.
Whereas if you pull back to groups of 20 to 50 people happily hunting and gathering on a landscape, why would you need a full-time scribe and dictionary managers when you can literally speak to most people? And so we don't see full-blown writing systems in those kinds of cultural environments because it would be a complete, it would be complete overkill, right?
Yeah.
So it's just not needed. And so that's where I really want to emphasize to your audience that writing's not like a pinnacle or an endpoint. And so people who don't have full-blown writing systems are somehow more primitive. It's usually more, they just didn't need it.
Like, yeah.
They have graphic communication. And so they've got lots of cool symbols and signs and art they can use to express themselves. They just don't need to be able to write things about, you know, statutes of law or other, you know, boring things, which is often what writing's used for.
So what's really interesting about you know, reading about this is, you know, the first full writing system, cuneiform, appeared around 3,500 years before Christ, right? So 3,500 BC. And so we're thinking it's about, you know, 6,000 years old. And then looking at these dots and crosses and lines that we see in much older work, it starts to show us that actually maybe there was the beginnings of writing way back then. And this happens quite a lot in paleoanthropology, it seems to me, that someone says, oh, this was 10,000 years ago. And then someone says, no, it wasn't. It was 300,000 years ago. And then says, no, 500,000 years ago. But it seems like we had writing way back, like 40,000 years ago. It's an insanely back.
Hold on. Let's back up the writing bus. Okay. So what we're seeing is cuneiform, as we think of it now with its little sticks and lines and, you know, very angular looking, is what happened once it became a full-blown writing system. And that was about 5,000 years ago.
Yeah.
Before that is proto-cuneiform. And first of all, for your listeners, it's really useful to understand proto-cuneiform was little pictures combined with counting marks. And so it wasn't full-blown writing. So a proto-writing system means that they've come up with a set of symbols or signs that they can use in a more restricted area. Like, so for instance, in China, because there's actually about three writing systems that all sort of appear around the same time, just so you know, in their proto state. And so China has their oracle bones, and those go back to like 8,000-9,000. Cuneiform in its proto early phase actually goes back to almost 10,000 years ago. And there's also proto hieroglyphs in Egypt that go back to before the empire, like again, to the pre-dynastic or whatever the heck they call it. So I'm so sorry to my Egyptology colleagues that I mess that up. But, you know, so 8,000 to 10,000 years ago around the world, we see people starting to create these smaller sets of signs for specific purposes. So, you know, in the Middle East, for instance, they were keeping track of economic transactions. So sad and banal, isn't it? But yeah, so they were tracking economic transactions. And so it was helpful to have a little picture of an ox and some sheaves of wheat, and then being able to count that they, you know, five sheaves of wheat, like five were traded for one goat. Like that was literally what they were doing with them.
Right.
But at that point, they couldn't write everything. Like they only could write these really restricted, like shorthand kind of thing, right? Like we can write about that. In China, they could write about, they used them for their oracles to try and predict the future. So again, very narrow set of signs and characters that were specifically to do with the gods, the ancestors, and trying to predict the future. And then in Egypt, you see something similar, which again is these very simple, very narrow domain, that's a good way to put it. So again, we're not talking full writing, and so I want to be really clear about that.
No, that's fine.
The actual writing doesn't start happening until later. So this is where, though, when we're thinking, if we're going back from there into the Paleolithic, so the Paleolithic is sort of 10,000 backwards, and then sort of the time we think of with modern humans, and when this art tradition is, you know, in full swing, is probably between 10,000 and about 50,000 years ago. And so what we're seeing is we start to see the first organization of these marks. Now, the marks themselves, some of them go back, you know, 100,000 plus years, but in a less organized fashion. Mm. And so what we start to see is we start to see them grouping them up more. And that's what's so intriguing about the recent study that they did where they were looking at the figurines in the Schwabian Jura area of Germany was they had this wonderful set of figurines and tools and other things where there's these very simple geometric marks on them, like lines and crosses and little angles and things like that, but they're repeating. And so this is where they were able to very cleverly look then for, you know, how often are they repeating? Is there a pattern to how it's working? And then does that match with what we see in early proto-cuneiform? So they weren't looking at full cuneiform either. They were looking at that earlier version I was talking about, where we're just starting to see people putting things into like a row. And so that's kind of where, that's more what they're comparing to. Not right,
but
like,
you know. You make this point, and I think it's really interesting that we can just say, well, they're not really writing because they're just kind of putting shapes together. But then you made this really interesting point about the cross, that a cross, just a cross to modern humans has a huge amount of meaning and understanding and significance behind it. When we think of the cross, there is so much information in just that one, those two lines that cross over each other. And so is it possible, I mean, we've done it year after year after decade, completely underestimated the abilities of both animals and prehistoric humans. Is it possible that actually we don't have the cultural understanding to know whether or not this actually might have been a much more rich set of, you know, marks that would have been very valid to call it a proto-language?
Yes. Okay. So the idea is that a Christian cross is literally two sticks that cross each other if you're not part of the cultural group who knows what it means. So say 100,000 years from now, you know, all the information about our society was gone other than, you know, they found a cross. They wouldn't necessarily, an archaeologist wouldn't know what it meant and couldn't understand. They might be able to be like, this was an important symbol to the people who lived at that time, right? But they wouldn't, without the unlock, if you will, that cultural unlock. And I completely agree. I'm not for a second saying that, you know, the humans who lived 40,000 years ago were not completely capable of having complex thoughts. I think they were, I mean, they were basically us in mind as well as in body. What I'm getting at more is that it doesn't seem like, it's not full writing for sure. With that said, they definitely, I'm sure they were meaningful. Like they definitely were. And I think that this is where, again, that idea of very simple characters can actually embed a whole lot of meaning. So again, the Christian cross, if you know what it means, those two sticks unlock 2,000 years of history, basically, right? From the Roman Empire to, you know, like the printing press to the Reformation to, like, you name it, it unlocks it all, right? And so if you don't know that, you would literally have no context. And so for sure, the people who lived during the Ice Age were definitely, you know, very smart people who probably were using those signs in ways that were, you know, like important to them. Like, but I don't think like they weren't writing soliloquies on the wall, right? Like it's very, they weren't writing full sentences. They weren't like, think of it more as like a logogram or something like that, which we see again in these early systems where a picture of an ox in early cuneiform represents an ox.
Yeah.
So it's probably going to be more like that. And if they're using the non-figurative marks, like we're seeing on the figurines, they very well could be either some form of counting, that could definitely be possible, or they could be some sort of mnemonic device, which means like a memory aid. So the idea being is that maybe they had really complex, you know, multi-part oral history stories that they told, and maybe those are help them remember the different chapters of the story, if you will. Like, if you think about a rosary,
if we managed to figure that out, that would be extremely exciting. Unfortunately, I suppose, you know, the Rosetta Stone, this amazing slab that was found that basically had translations of hieroglyphics on it. I mean, you couldn't have come across a more amazing find than the Rosetta Stone. Yeah. And it basically unlocked what hieroglyphics meant. We won't have this certainly for anything because you know, they didn't have language in the same way as we have now. And they certainly didn't have the number of people that was required to translate it to different languages, even if they did have complex language. But could AI be the Rosetta Stone to unlock what these symbols may have meant, do you think?
Well, first of all, I think, okay, so again, remember going back to our standardization point for writing, during the Ice Age, the marks in general are not that standardized. Like, because it's you know, it's more like this person might do it a little bit this way and this person might do it a little bit that way. Mm. So A, you've got more variation. So you're not, that's probably going to be one of the first problems, is that there's, it's hard. The Rosetta Stone had full blown writing systems on it, which I mean, you pointed out too. Yeah. So these were full writing systems with enough characters repeating across. And then also they were able to anchor it again with the name of one of the pharaohs. That's actually really how it all started. And that's how they kind of cracked it from there, was they were able to recognize that that was the name of one of the pharaohs, which they knew from one of the temples. And then from there, they were able to say, well, wait a second, we noticed that there's this rectangular shape around his name, and now we're seeing other rectangular shapes. What if those are the names of other people? And so they had a reference base to work with. Obviously, as you said too, we don't have that. So that is definitely one of the big problems. So, I mean, I'm actually working on a AI integrated research system for our fields right now. And so I'm very interested in pattern recognition. And I think, though, this is where what we need to split off is with the geometric science. So with those little X's and the lines and some of the other different marks that I've identified and other researchers have identified, in some cases, at least, I mean, I think they're actually real world objects that we just have not been properly identified as, like, so for instance, there's one that looks like a feather. And so it's called a penniform. But if you look at it, it appears on the sides of bison sometimes. It looks an awful like a spear. Like, it's probably a spear. It's probably not a geometric abstract shape. It's actually probably a real world item that just hasn't been categorized correctly yet. And so, you know, I think that with those marks, there is the potential to be able to figure out what some of them depict, I would say. And so again, kind of like we can look at a wall and see a picture of a bison and we're like, oh, it's a bison. We know what it depicts, right? That doesn't mean we know what the bison represents to the people who made it. And so for some people, it could be they looked out the cave door and they saw a bison and they thought it was pretty and they painted it on a wall. Other people might have been trying to capture the spirit of the bison before they went on a hunt so that they could ensure success in the hunt. Hmm. Other people might have been telling the story about the origin of their people coming to that place, and maybe they trace their heritage back to, you know, a marriage between a bison and a human, right? Like we don't know what it meant to them, but we might be able to figure out what it is. And so I would say that's going to be, that's the problem, is there's not, and this is the difference between what we see then and between writing. There's not enough repetition. There's not enough characters. And it's not, it's not standardized enough for us to have enough to work with.
So you're coming to Ireland in June, having used some AI to help you predict where we might find ancient cave art. Is that right?
Yes. Okay. So what might be helpful for your listeners to know is that traditionally it was thought that Ireland was under an ice sheet during the entire Ice Age, and therefore it was impossible for people to live there. Now, though, we're realizing that there was actually ice-free corridor areas. And then during the later part of the Ice Age, the ice sheets actually receded. And what's really, really cool is that during the Ice Age, so much of the water was locked up in the ice that you could walk from Wales to like across the St. George Channel to Ireland, and it was only about 60 kilometers away. So it's actually quite reasonable that people could have lived there, because we now have sites in Wales that date to between 15 and 17,000 years ago. And hunter-gatherer territories are often 100 plus kilometers, like they're big. And there's very similar conditions in Southern Ireland to what we see in the areas in Wales. And so this was a first test for my brand new shiny baby AI, is that we're actually going to try and see if we're using all of the conditions that we know existed in Wales, can we then use the AI to help us predict where we should go look in Southern Ireland if we wanted to find something? Now, the key here is that when you survey four sites, because I've worked on four continents and in over 100 caves, so I've worked in a lot of places. And the key to finding art is, step one, you have to find the people. And so this is what we're doing here, is step one, can we find the people? Are there people in this part of the landscape? And then if we can find them, that would be the tools, and then hopefully maybe the art.
Okay, that sounds very, very cool. I might be in touch about that. It would be nice to ride along. Genevieve von Petzinger, paleoanthropologist and rock art researcher, thank you so much for your time.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, that's it from us on this week's episode. Welcome return to producer Aidan McKelvey. Rory Galvin was on podcast. Hugo da Silva was on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sunday from midday. News Talk. Conversation that counts.